only made things worse. Before our first game, I made a decision, and it changed everything for me. Instead of trying to be better than them, I decided to focus on making the other players better. And I told them so. The moment my playing became about them and not about me, my insecurity faded and I became a better contributor to our team. If you have insecurities, especially those driven by other strengths or differences, start working on them. If you don't, your leadership will harm, not help, the team. Number 6, failing to be inclusive. The final common barrier to promoting team diversity is the leader and team members' failure to be inclusive. When people are on your team but don't feel like they belong or contribute, they disconnect, and they don't bring their best gifts and talents to the table. For many years, I've taught people to seek common ground with others as the way to start the connection process, and to further that process by valuing people and adding value to them. I still believe this is the way to start. But the whole idea of inclusion and how it relates to diversity is changing because of millennials. I recently read a study about the approach millennials take to the marketplace, and I thought, no wonder the number one question I'm asked in the business community is how to interact with millennials. The study was called The Radical Transformation of Diversity and Inclusion, The Millennial Influence, and it was published by Deloitte University. It said that my generation of baby boomers, as well as Generation Xers, see inclusion as a function of morality, the right thing to do. We would define it in terms of representation or ensuring fair inclusion of gender, race, religion, ethnicity, and sexual orientation. Baby boomers might not see the practical value in diversity and inclusion. Their focus would be on compliance, ethics, and equality. In contrast, millennials see diversity and inclusion as having intrinsic value. They allow voices to be heard that have a tangible and beneficial impact on business. The goal isn't just bringing people together of different races, religions, and genders. Instead, they want to bring together people with differences in backgrounds, personal experiences, style, and perspective. How these people are brought together is also important to millennials. As the study authors Christy Smith and Stephanie Turner explain, when it comes to defining inclusion, millennials focus primarily and extensively on teaming, valuing a culture of connectivity, and using collaborative tools to drive business impact. Older generations instead define inclusion in terms of equality, fairness, integration, acceptance, the tolerance of gender, racial, and ethnic diversities within the organization. Millennials are just happy to have people at the table. They want everyone to be seen as a contributor, and inclusion hasn't occurred until they have empowered that to happen. These differences in thinking and approach have a huge impact in the workplace, and that impact will only increase. By 2025, 75% of the workplace will be made up of millennials. Currently, the majority of millennials feel less included and connected than people in the workplace from other generations. Millennials are 13% more likely to disagree with the statement that they feel excited to go to work. Overall, millennials are 13% more likely to disagree with the statement that they feel attached to the organization. And millennials are 33% more likely to disagree with the statement that their work has an impact on the organization. Smith and Turner suggested that good leadership supporting inclusion and diversity will help millennials to become fully engaged. Leaders can do that by providing a collaborative environment in which employees can see the impact of their work, understand the value they bring to the organization, and are recognized for their efforts. Leaders believe in openness and transparency and demonstrate that a cognitively diverse team is better for business. How to leadership to diversity and inclusion. If you're a millennial, you're probably saying amen. If you're a boomer or Gen Xer, you're likely supportive of creating an environment that is diverse and inclusive, but you aren't sure what to do with these different ways of thinking and these alternate perspectives. I have three suggestions. Number one, create a culture of sharing. No matter how diverse the workplace is, teams will not embrace creativity unless there is a culture conducive to interaction and sharing of knowledge. This requires a de-emphasizing of titles, positions, and roles. It means inviting everyone to speak up. It means giving people opportunities to lead before they have an official role, and sometimes even before you feel that they are fully ready. And it means being more open to differences. Smith and Turner pointed out, millennials yearn for self-expression and acceptance of their thoughts and opinions, but compared to older generations, they feel it's unnecessary to downplay their differences in order to get ahead. Millennials are refusing to check their identities at the door of organizations today, and they strongly believe these characteristics bring value to the business outcomes and impact. When you share space, share responsibility, share ownership, and share rewards, everyone wants to contribute. Number two, broaden your perspective on diversity. In an article in Harvard Business Review, a business psychology professor wrote, "Most discussions about diversity focus on demographic variables such as gender, age, and race. However, the most interesting and influential aspects of diversity are psychological, personality, values, and abilities. This is also the way millennials see it. Equality isn't just about giving everyone the same things. It's also about giving unique people what they need." Bernard Tyson, CEO of Kaiser Permanente, says, "We've evolved from equality to equity. Equality says everyone gets equal. Equality says no, everyone gets what they need." Part of building an inclusive environment is not how you're going to change the person. It's how you're going to change yourself and the environment in which the person is going to be successful. That requires us to think differently and treat diversity differently. Number three, provide solid leadership for diversity to be effective. As much as diversity can help a team, it can also challenge a team. Bringing together a diverse group of people isn't easy. Too great a diversity on a team can be problematic. I think of it as the Samson syndrome, the pairing of great strength with great weakness. The strength of diversity is problem solving and the idea creation. The weakness comes from decision making and implementation. There's a difference between generating ideas and implementing ideas. While diverse team composition does seem to confer an advantage when it comes to generating a wider range of original and useful ideas, experimental studies suggest that such benefits disappear once the team is tasked with deciding which ideas to select and implement. Creativity gains produced by higher team diversity are disrupted by the inherent social conflict and decision-making deficits that less homogeneous teams create. Good leadership can help bring strength to both ideation and implementation. I'm still on the journey when it comes to shifting from uniformity to diversity. Why? Because the way people think is still changing and I have to change to become a better leader. The greatest shift was from thinking I was right to realizing that people are different but not wrong. Once I was able to see from their perspective, I better saw their view and I became open to it. There's something of a paradox in all of this. To embrace diversity, we must celebrate our differences. But I still believe the way we get there is to look for common ground. In the end, I think we all want the same thing, to be heard, to value one another, to work together, to be successful, and to make a difference. If we can connect where we're similar and contribute using our differences, we can accomplish great things. The chapter that we just read together is the one shift that is still the most difficult for me to make. Not because I'm unwilling or unable, it's just because it's a process that I've gone through that I seem to be slower in than the other shifts. And I say that because when you go through this book, you're going to find perhaps one shift or two that are very easy for you. And in fact, you've already made them and said, oh, John was really good in those chapters. But you're going to probably then find a chapter or two that brings you great difficulty. And I say that because I want you to know that even I, as the author, just haven't handled all these shifts easily, quickly, or even always effectively. But it's okay, because I'm learning to shift. And I know this, if I don't change, I won't get better, I won't grow. That change does mean that I am growing. So I want to encourage you when you think of diversity. I can remember when I was a very young leader, very young, going to a conference called Exchange. And I just loved this conference. I didn't participate in it because I felt I was so young, I didn't have really anything to offer. But it was a group of about 50 leaders who took time exchanging and sharing ideas that worked for their organizations. Now, I took pages and pages of notes. But when I finished with all the learning of that exchange experience, what I came away from was this. These all leaders were very successful, and they were growing their organization, but they were doing it differently. They were diverse. They weren't all following a similar plan, and they weren't all cookie cutter as far as their approach. They just were different. And yet, when they would share how they were doing it, everybody was learning and everybody was having aha moments, and they're saying, oh, I could do that. I left that exchange conference and I basically said to myself, I loved the interaction that took place, and I loved how diversity trumped everything else, that we learned from each other because we were different. Same goal, build great companies and organizations, but different paths that we took. In fact, I took that idea, and I, for several years, have led a leadership experience called Exchange. It's a small group of people, about 120 people, and we meet in a different city somewhere in the world every year, and we spend 3 days having leadership experiences. And again, different cities, different places, different companies, different experiences. All of this variety, all of this diversity, just adds great value to who we are and to who we will become. So I just close this thought by saying, I think we cheat ourselves when we don't cross the bridge, meet people that are different, and appreciate them and value them, ask questions from them, and let them become our teacher. I encourage you, as we get ready for chapter 10, to take a moment and ask yourself in this book, through our first 9 chapters, which is your easiest leader shift and which one's going to be your most difficult? Again, I just shared what mine was, but you'll have one or two. It's okay. It's okay. Remember, we're never down. We're either up or we're getting up. Chapter 10, Positional Authority to Moral Authority, The Influence Shift. The true measure of leadership is influence, nothing more, nothing less. That's what I teach in my book, The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. It's very true. I've been known for my definition of leadership for more than 45 years. Leadership is influence. If you've led people for any length of time, you probably know instinctively that this is true. But have you ever wondered where the influence comes from? No authority. I found myself asking that question in my first leadership job. Just a few weeks out of college, I became a pastor of a small rural church in the farming community of Hillham, Indiana. The word community almost makes it sound bigger than it really was. 11 houses, 2 gas stations, and 1 little country store. It was a job I thought I could handle in an environment where I could learn the ropes. The church wasn't big, it wasn't in a city, and there were no titans of industry to deal with. I would be a medium fish in a small pond. The bylaws of the organization said that I was the leader of the congregation and the chairman of the organization's board. I thought that made me a leader. The first time I met with the board, I prepared for it. I thought about the vision and how I would articulate it. I thought about how I wanted the meeting to go, and I wrote a detailed agenda. I knew that as the chairman, I was supposed to open the meeting and run it. So after the introductions and greetings were finished and we were sitting around the table, I prepared to start. But before I could say or do anything, Claude, one of the board members, said, "Pastor, why don't you open us up in prayer?" That's a good idea, I thought, and so I prayed. I opened up the file folder with the copies of my agenda in it and was about to hand them out when Claude said, "There are a couple of things I think we ought to talk about tonight." Oh, I thought, okay. We can take care of those things first, and then, of course, we'll get to my agenda. Claude led the discussion and asked questions while the other men responded. I listened and tried to follow along. Most of the things they were dealing with were the kind of mundane, everyday items that need to be done in an organization, so there was nothing earth-shattering. After about an hour, Claude said, "Well, that's about it, Pastor. Why don't you close us in prayer?" So I said a prayer, and everybody got up, shook hands, said their goodbyes, and I went home. And I thought to myself, what just happened? Where does authority come from? That's the day I learned that a leadership position does not give someone leadership authority. And having a title is not the same thing as having influence. I had the title, but everyone followed Claude. His opinion was the one that mattered at the table. Everyone agreed with everything he said, and they were glad to do what he said. Back then, I had not yet discovered my definition of leadership, but after that board meeting, I began thinking about the topic, and I started trying to figure out why all the board members followed Claude. He was a middle-aged farmer who also worked at a nearby power plant. He wasn't an especially impressive man. He wasn't educated, but he had influence. I look back now and I realize that in the small world of Hillham, Claude had a degree of moral authority. To the people in that church and on that board, his words carried great weight. Why? Because of the way he lived his life. He was a good man. He was honest, fair, and hardworking. His words and actions lined up, and they had been true for decades. He cared for the congregation and was always ready to help. Claude would not have recognized himself as a leader or called himself a leader, yet he had earned the right to be followed. When it comes to leadership, I think there are all kinds of authority. Here are some examples. Natural authority. Some people naturally lead better than others and therefore step into leadership roles. Positional authority. This kind of authority comes with a title or a formal position in an organization and is the lowest level of leadership. Knowledge authority. Knowing more than others do or having specific information can give people an influence edge. Situational authority. A certain circumstance can arise that require the most qualified person to lead in that situation. Relational authority. When people have built relationships with others, that gives them influence to lead. Proximity authority. When individuals are close to the real leader or authority figure, they can borrow from the leader's influence to lead others. Success authority. Success gives people credibility and others want to be on their team to be part of their success. Mentoring authority. Developers of other people increase their influence with the people they mentor and gain a reputation for credibility. Seniority authority. In some cultures, being an elder or having seniority in an organization gives authority. My experience with Claude started me on a journey toward understanding different kinds of leadership authority. It helped me settle my definition of leadership. It prompted me to develop the 5 levels of leadership, which I mentioned in Chapter 5 on the leader shift from pleasing people to challenging people. And it ultimately led me to the concept of moral authority, which is the highest level of influence. For 50 years, I have been in the process of the influence shift from positional authority to moral authority. It's a journey I'm still on and a shift that I'm still working to make. What is moral authority? It can be difficult to define. On his blog, Theodore Brown acknowledges that the term is used a lot, but he also states how difficult moral authority is to define. One example he gives is what we call the John McCain effect, which he says is the capacity to convince others of how the world should be. Here's another perspective from Harvard Business professor Kevin Scherer. He wrote, "Moral authority is not easy to define precisely, but like many things, you know it when you see it, or especially when you do not." Lack of moral authority in leaders breeds distrust, creates cynicism, and kills initiative throughout the organization. Over time, the lack of strong moral authority in the leadership is fatal to the enterprise or country. These perspectives may make moral authority sound grandiose. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. Claude had moral authority and didn't even know it. But so did Nelson Mandela and Mother Teresa. So what is moral authority? Here's my definition. Moral authority is the recognition of a person's leadership influence based on who they are more than the position they hold. It is attained by authentic living that has built trust, and it is sustained by successful leadership endeavors. It is earned by a lifetime of consistency. Leaders can strive to earn moral authority by the way they live, but only others can grant them moral authority. Moral authority is truly the highest level of leadership influence, and many people recognize it. It comes from possessing good values. It adds value to others. It inspires people. It helps the leader to make the right decisions for the right reasons. It marks a life of words and actions that line up. We know when we're in the presence of someone who has moral authority, and we want to follow them. In Four Ways to Build Moral Authority, Chuck Olson said, "People follow people, not positions. Your business card may say you're a leader and in charge, but if your bank account of moral authority is overdrawn, you will be forced to rely on extrinsic factors to rally your followers. No amount of skill, wealth, personality, education, or accomplishment can compensate for the absence of moral authority. Perks and paychecks are the currency required to enlist people in a project, but moral authority is the currency required to enlist people in a movement." Andy Stanley, in his book, Next Generation Leaders, observes, "Your position will prompt people in your organization to lend you their hands, but your moral authority will inspire them to lend you their hearts." Moral authority has the implicit power to transform what is into what can be. It takes people to higher levels of living and leading. It's inspirational, yet at the same time, it is grounded and credible. It makes leaders better because they desire to do better. Moral authority brings out the best in teams because of the respect team members have for the leaders and the desire team members have to live up to and follow their example. The pathway to moral authority. One of the dangers when anyone begins discussing moral authority is that it can sound mystical and out of reach. However, it is grounded in four things: competence, courage, consistency, and character. I believe anyone can pursue moral authority and develop greater influence by developing in all four of these areas. Let's take a look at each one of them. Number one, competence, the ability to lead well. Everything starts here. Competence is the core of moral authority. If you can't do your job, if you can't deliver the goods, if you can't lead the team well, why would anyone want to follow you? You can't cultivate moral authority unless people respect you. Author George L. Davis observed, "Authority is not something we buy, are born with, or even have delegated to us by our superiors. It is something we earn, and we earn it from our subordinates. No manager has any real authority over his people until he has proved himself worthy of it in the eyes of his people, not his own, nor of those of his superiors." How do people build a foundation of competence? By giving your best, starting with the small stuff. Dale Carnegie said, "Don't be afraid to give your best to what seemingly are small jobs. Every time you conquer one, it makes you that much stronger." If you do the little jobs well, the big ones tend to take care of themselves. Doing work with excellence to full completion helps a person develop a reputation for competence. Oscar Hammerstein, too, who was one of the great lyricists of American theater, he wrote songs for shows such as The Sound of Music, The Keen and I, Oklahoma, and South Pacific. His advice to writers and artists is equally valuable for business people and leaders. This is a very important thing for writers to remember. You never know when you will be found out if your work is careless. A year or so ago, on the cover of the New York Herald Tribune Sunday magazine, I saw a picture of the Statue of Liberty. It was a picture taken from a helicopter, and it showed the top of the statue's head. I was amazed at the detail there. The sculptor had done a painstaking job with the lady's coffer, and yet he must have been pretty sure that the only eyes that would ever see this detail would be the uncritical eyes of seagulls. He could not have dreamt that any man would ever fly over this head and take a picture of it. He was artist enough, however, to finish off this part of the statue with as much care as he had devoted to her face and her arms and the torch and everything that people can see as they sail up the bay. He was right. When you are creating a work of art, or any kind of work, finish the job off perfectly. Doing your work with devotion to excellence and the will to follow through will give you a positive reputation for competence. That's true in any profession. But leaders need to also cultivate influence with others and demonstrate competence in their ability to engage with people and motivate and inspire them to work together. 40 years ago, I started teaching the 5 levels of leadership to help people understand how influence worked and to teach them a growth process that they could follow to become better leaders. I write about this more fully in my book, Developing the Leader Within You 2.0. But I want to summarize it here to help you get a feel of how you can develop your leadership competence. Level 1, which is the lowest level, is the position level. People follow you because they have to. The authority someone receives at this level is very limited, and it's restricted to the leader's job description. A leader need not be competent to receive a leadership appointment. In some organization, that person doesn't even have to be competent to retain a leadership position. Level 2 is the permission level. People follow because they want to. A leader begins to develop authority at this second level. When the leader builds relationships, people are willing to work with them because they like them and enjoy spending time with them. They are beginning to give permission for the person to lead them. Level 3, production. People follow because you demonstrate competence. On this third level, a leader begins to demonstrate genuine competence. Being productive is a big step in gaining moral authority with others. People follow because the leader has produced results and is successful, and they want to be on a winning team. Level 4, people development. People follow because you help them become competent. When you start to invest in people and help them to become successful personally, your level of authority rises dramatically. The lives of the people that you lead begin to improve, and this gives you a level of credibility that you can gain no other way. Level 5, pinnacle. People follow because you have a reputation for excellence. When you live a life of competence, influence people at each of the first 4 levels, and develop leaders over a long period of time, you can approach the pinnacle level of leadership. This is where true moral authority is established. Moral authority is not based on position, but you must learn the skills at each level of leadership and master them to be seen as highly competent in leadership. However, competence alone is not enough to earn moral authority. Number 2, courage. Moving forward in the face of fear. Leadership authority shrinks or expands with a person's courage. Author and professor C.S. Lewis said, "Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point. Without courage, you can't live any other virtue consistently. With courage, especially when facing great obstacles, you begin to gain moral authority. I think everyone admires courage, and intuitively, we understand that it carries weight. We can follow a leader who is courageous. More specifically, here's how courage relates to moral authority. Courage encourages people during difficult and uncertain times. There is perhaps no greater need for courage from a leader than during difficult times. Poet Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Whatever you do, you need courage. Whatever course you decide upon, there is always someone to tell you that you are wrong. There are always difficulties arising which tempt you to believe that your critics are right. To map out a course of action and follow it to the end requires some of the same courage which a soldier needs. Peace has its victories, but it takes brave men and women to win them." The courage that people need to see and feel during difficult times does not have to be loud or dramatic, though many times it is. The difficulties of our everyday lives often require us to find and display courage. Author and artist Mary Ann Rodmacher said that courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day saying, "I will try again tomorrow." Courage enables people to maximize their potential. In Making the Courage Connection, Doug Hall wrote, "Courage has a tangible quality. You can't touch it, but you can feel it. It feels like positive acceleration. Courage sends a rush of energy through your body. It makes you wake up in the morning with a feeling of wanting to wrap your hands around the day. Being courageous not only fires you up, but also fires up others and makes them more courageous. That's important, because nobody ever reached his or her potential by cowering in fear. Fortune favors the bold." One of my favorite stories of courage is about David of Israel before he became king. Most people are aware that David fought Goliath with a sling and defeated him, but many people know little more than that about the story. When David stepped out to battle Goliath, the rest of Israel's army, including King Saul and David's older brothers, were cowering in fear. None of them had the courage to face Goliath, who had challenged their army and taunted them daily, waiting for a champion to meet him. David, a boy with no military experience, had the courage to fight the Philistine giant, took him down with a stone, and then cut off his head with the warrior's own sword. In that moment, the entire army of Israel found their courage because of David's heroic act. They attacked and routed the Philistine army. Time after time, before he was king and during his reign, David's courage inspired his people to do their best. His closest allies were men who also became great warriors because they were inspired by his courage. Under David's leadership, the nation expanded its borders, conquered its enemies, and achieved peace. Courage helps leaders find their voice. As leaders display courage in crisis, they often find their voices. During World War II, when England stood alone against Nazi Germany, Winston Churchill found his voice. In 1940, while addressing Parliament, he told his countrymen, "We shall never surrender." Martin Luther King, Jr. found his voice during the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. His words still resound today. "Our lives begin to end the day we remain silent about things that matter." A remarkable story of a leader who found his voice is told in Profiles in Courage by John F. Kennedy. When Andrew Johnson became president following the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, Johnson was determined to carry out Lincoln's policies regarding the South. It was Lincoln's desire to bring healing quickly to the nation after the Civil War, and Johnson, who was from Tennessee, recognized Lincoln's policy as the best course of action. Johnson's fellow Republicans in Congress desired a different path. They wanted to punish the Southern states for seceding. And when Johnson resisted their policies and vetoed much of the legislation they passed, The most radical wing of the Republican Party became determined to impeach Johnson and remove him from office. All the Democrats in the Senate opposed impeachment, as did six Republicans. If all the remaining Republicans voted in favor, then Johnson would be removed from office. But one senator from Kansas, Edmund G. Ross, who was believed to be a supporter of the radicals, would not vote to impeach the president because he believed it would signal the end of the divided powers of government and permanently damage the country, turning the United States into a partisan congressional autocracy. Ross later commented, "I almost literally looked down into my open grave. Friendships, positions, fortune, everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by the breath of my mouth, perhaps forever." When asked how he voted, he answered, "Not guilty," and Johnson was not impeached. Shortly after the trial, he said to his wife, "Millions of men cursing me today will bless me tomorrow for having saved the country from the greatest peril through which it has ever passed, though none but God can ever know the struggle it has cost me." And it did cost him. At the next election, he was voted out of office. When he returned home after his term, he was ostracized and attacked and lived in near poverty. Every leader who possesses moral authority has to stand alone at some point in time. Such moments make leaders. Such stands are often very difficult. But when leaders look back afterward, they often see those as their proudest moments. We don't choose the times or the circumstances we must face in life, but we do choose our responses. I love the prayer of the Special Olympics because I think it represents the mindset that we should embrace as leaders. Let me win, but if I cannot win, let me be brave in the attempt. Number 3, consistency. Doing well all the time, not just sometimes. In his fantastic book, Visioneering, Andy Stanley described the value of consistency related to moral authority. He wrote, "It is the alignment between a person's convictions and his behavior that makes his life persuasive. Herein is the key to sustained influence." The phrase that best captures this dynamic is moral authority. To gain and maintain your influence, you must have moral authority. Moral authority is the critical non-negotiable, can't be without ingredient of sustained success. Without moral authority, your influence will be limited and short-lived. Moral authority is the credibility you earn by walking your talk. It is the relationship other people see between what you say and what you do, between what you claim to be and what you are. A person with moral authority is beyond reproach. That is, when you look for discrepancy between what he says, he believes, and what he does, you come up empty. There is an alignment between conviction and action, belief and behavior. Nothing compensates for a lack of moral authority. No amount of communication skills, wealth, accomplishment, education, talent, or position can make up for a lack of moral authority. We all know plenty of people who have those qualities, but who exercise no influence over us whatsoever. Why? Because there is a contradiction between what they claim to be and what we perceive them to be. What Stanley described is internal consistency between values and actions, which is essential to a leader's success if he or she desires to gain moral authority. Equally important is the ability to be consistent over time. Now that I'm in my 70s, people have started to ask me questions that prompt me to think back on my life. Probably the most common question is, "John, now that you're in your 70s, what has been your greatest surprise in life?" I think of these old man questions because nobody asks them of young leaders, and they make me chuckle because they mean that I look much older than I feel, but I still attempt to honestly answer them. There are two things that surprise me. The first is how fast time has gone by. I still can't believe I'm over 70. The second is the value of consistency. Consistency compounds in a way I never realized. If you do the right thing when you're young, it goes mostly unnoticed and unrecognized. But if you do the right things and lead well over decades, it becomes recognized and you get more credit than you deserve. That's the power of what I called layered living. If you embrace layered learning, as I described in Chapter 3 on shifting from goals to growth, and you practice layered leadership by consistently living out your values and performing them with excellence, then your reward can be layered living, where you reap the benefits of moral authority. Consistency is so valuable to a leader that it's difficult to list all of its benefits. Here are just a few. Consistency establishes your reputation. Nearly anyone can be good once. Being good continually is difficult. However, continued repetition leads to a positive reputation. Consistency makes team members more secure. Perhaps the greatest compliment a person can receive is, "I can depend on you." A consistent leader inspires team members to become more confident. Consistency allows for accurate measurement of your growth. It's difficult to gauge the progress of inconsistent people. The track record we establish shows what we have done and how far we have come. Consistency makes you relevant. People who bounce back and forth between engagement and disengagement always have to play catch-up. By staying consistently engaged, you don't fall far behind. Consistency models your expectations for others. When you consistently model your values and work ethic, team members know what you expect of them because they've seen it every day. Consistency always reinforces expectations. Consistency maintains your message. When a leader communicates a vision but acts in ways that are inconsistent with that vision, the result is confusion. It distracts from the message and makes it more difficult for everyone on the team. Consistency, along with competence and courage, is vital to a leader's ability to develop moral authority. But there's still one more component without which moral authority is impossible to earn. Number 4, character. Being bigger on the inside than the outside. Moral authority is a result of right intentions, right values, right beliefs, right actions, right relationships, and right responses. There is a lot to do right to develop moral authority. That doesn't mean perfection. We're all human and make mistakes. But to have moral authority, our intentions must be right. The motives of the heart must be good. While much of leadership is outward and public, the right motives and the good character traits we need to become as leaders with moral authority are one in private. These two aspects of leadership, public and private, resemble the two parts of a tree. One part you see, our public leadership, is like a tree's trunk and branches. That's the part that bears fruit. However, who leaders are in private is what can't be seen, like the tree's roots. If the roots are shallow, then the tree won't survive. Drought will dry it up, a storm will knock it down. But if the roots are deep, the tree can thrive in almost any circumstance. What does it mean to develop deep roots as a leader? It means having strong character. What kind of character does a leader need to have? I believe good character demonstrates these four characteristics. Integrity. I define integrity two ways. First is the alignment of our values and actions. You know what's right and you do it. Integrity has consistency, as I discussed earlier in this chapter. But consistency is specific to what's right and wrong, not just what's good and best. Leaders with moral authority hold themselves to a high standard of conduct. The second definition has to do with decision-making. Leaders of integrity do the right thing, even when it's hard, even when it's not best for them personally. They put the team, the organization, and the vision ahead of themselves. Authenticity. Author and spiritual leader Mark Batterson said, "Authenticity is the new authority in leadership." I agree, because I believe that it is an essential part of moral authority. People do not want to follow leaders who pretend to be what they're not. They don't need perfection, just honesty. This can be a real struggle for many leaders. They want to meet others' expectations and can be tempted to compromise their beliefs or standards. I felt this pull early in my career as a young pastor. The organization I was part of held some theological positions that I was personally uncomfortable with. For a couple of years, I felt an obligation to teach on these issues, but I always felt as though I was promoting something I didn't believe in, and it made me miserable. Then one day, as I prepared a message that I was struggling with, I resolved to change. I marked my resolve by writing down these three statements. 1, I will only teach what I believe. That gives me passion. 2, I will only teach what I experience. That gives me confidence. 3, I will only teach what I live. That gives me authenticity. I have followed those guidelines ever since. Those decisions made me not only a better communicator, but also a better leader. To be the best leader you can be, you need to acknowledge who you really are and be willing to let people witness your authenticity. Humility. I believe humility is an essential quality of a leader who possesses moral authority. In his book Good to Great, Jim Collins called this a compelling modesty. He wrote, "We are struck by how the good to great leaders didn't talk about themselves. When pressed to talk about themselves, they say things like, 'I hope I'm not sounding like a big shot.' It wasn't just false modesty. Those who worked with or wrote about the good to great leaders continually use words like quiet, humble, modest, reserved, shy, gracious, mild-mannered, self-effacing, understated, did not believe his own clippings, and so forth. As a person of faith, I see humility as making the everyday choice to credit God for my blessings and to credit others for my successes. How would you describe it? My friend Rick Warren said, humility is not denying your strength. Humility is being honest about your weaknesses. No matter how you define humility, know that it means 3 things. First, you possess self-awareness and can criticize yourself. Second, you're confident and comfortable enough that you don't feel that you need to draw any attention to yourself. And third, you revel in the accomplishments of others and are eager to help them shine. Love. The final character quality to embrace as a leader in order to have moral authority is love. You must care about people. You must respect them. You must value them. People can always tell when you don't, and that creates an instant disconnection that short-circuits moral authority. I've talked a little bit about the John Maxwell team. Our motto is, people of value who value people. I want our coaches to have resources and expertise to offer, and I want them to value others so that their character and their attitudes are right when working with people. They need to love people and care about them enough to help them. What do you want to do with your leadership? I think every leader wants to make an impact, a difference. It's the reason we get up in the morning. It's why we work with people. It's why we create teams or build organizations. Do you have it in you to do something big? Do you want to change your organization or your community or your culture or your country? How big are your dreams? The bigger they are, the more you need moral authority to accomplish them. When I was in my 30s, I started to get the sense that my leadership could be impactful and my life could make a difference. That prompted me to make some personal decisions. At the time, I simply thought that they were the right things to do to be a better leader. Today, I can see that they helped me in the 4 areas I've written about in this chapter: competence, courage, consistency, and character. Here's what I decided. I decided to, first, always put people first. Secondly, live to make a difference, not to make money. Thirdly, be myself, but be my best self possible. Fourth, express gratitude. Reject entitlement. 5, be willing to be misunderstood and lonely for the right reasons. I've worked hard to follow these guidelines for the last 40 years. In the end, you don't get to grant yourself moral authority. You can choose to strive for it, but only others can give it to you, and they must do so freely. But that should not stop you from doing everything right that you can to earn it. Because if you gain moral authority, it makes you worthy of respect, inspires trust and confidence, and enables you to lead at the highest standards of performance. This leadership will increase your influence, giving you buy-in not only from the people on your team, but from others who aren't under your formal leadership. And with that influence, there's no telling what you can help other people accomplish. Together we've just read the chapter on moving from and shifting from positional authority to moral authority. I made a statement in that chapter. I'm sure you caught it, but let me just go back to it and use it as a foundation for my few moments with you. I made the statement, anybody can be good once. Consistency compounds. Well, sometimes I make the statement, I tell people that you're never good the first time, and that's also true. But there are people, they can shine for the moment. They can star perhaps for one play in their life, but they have never understood that when you consistently do the right thing, then it begins to compound into something that's really, really big. Yesterday I had a conversation with Jim Collins. Our friendship is wonderful, and I so admire what he does in writing and how he inspires leaders such as myself and you. And we were talking, and Jim was asking me some questions about what was happening right now to me, and I was sharing with him that we're doing some wonderful things in countries on transformation. And I laughed and I said, Jim, you know, people think that I'm better than I really am. And we were laughing about that comment, and because it was a life of years, decades of consistency until it compounds on me. And so I said, but Jim, I kind of take that today, because when I started off, people thought that I was worse than I really was. And in the beginning, I wanted to, you know, raise my hand and say, look, folks, I'm bad, but I'm not that bad. I missed it, but wow. I'm capable of missing a lot more than I've shown you or that I have missed. And what we were laughing about and agreeing with in this conversation, that when we start off, consistency is never rewarded. Nobody gives you an award after you've been at work for one week. They don't say, oh my gosh, here's a trophy. You've been here a whole 5 days. This is amazing. No. Consistency goes unrecognized for a long period of time. That's why I think that we leave it so often. That's why we give up, because we just say, wow, I've been doing this for a few years. Nobody seems to care. Nobody doesn't seem to make a difference. Doesn't seem to matter. But it's so essential. And just as it doesn't show up in the beginning of our life, when it starts to show up, it really starts to show up. I mean, it shows up big time. I mean, all of a sudden, people look and say, wow, look what they've been doing all this time. And then it begins to catch on, and then it begins to be contagious. And so consistency not only compounds, after you've done it for a while, it begins to be contagious in the lives of others. And what I'm saying, and as I taught about moral authority in this chapter, is this. It's impossible to have moral authority quickly. You don't get it by shortcuts. It's not a quick fix. But once you get on this path of pursuing moral authority, it will make you better today. And what I want you to know is moral authority may not show up until tomorrow in your life, but if you're consistent today, that will show up, and that will give you the fruit of the leadership that you really need and that you really want. So I don't know where you are in your leadership journey. Maybe you're young, and if you're young, you're saying, you're right, John. I'm not as bad as people think I am. Or maybe you're old like myself, and now you're reaping all the benefits of this consistency and this moral authority, and you're wanting to say, you raise your hand and say, I'm not as good as you people think I am. Regardless of where you are in the journey, here's what I know. Keep doing the right thing, because it will pay off in the long run. Blessings on you as you take this moral authority journey. Chapter 11, Trained Leaders to Transformational Leaders, The Impact Shift. If your actions inspire people to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, then you are a transformational leader. Of all the chapters in this book, this one is the most important. Now, why do I say that? Because if you make only one leader shift in your life, this is the one I wish that you would choose. The impact shift from trained leaders to transformational leaders will bring the greatest change to your life and the lives of those around you. If your actions inspire people to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, then you are a transformational leader. You influence people to think, speak, and act in ways that make a positive difference in their lives and the lives of others. That kind of leadership can change the world. My change in leadership perspective. My leadership shift from trained leader to transformational leader occurred early. The story is very personal to me, and it had a dramatic effect on my life. At the heart of this shift was my faith, which is the foundation of who I am. However, I value you whether or not you're a person of faith. No matter what your perspective is about faith, I don't want you to miss this, so I'll condense my story down to its essence. At the beginning of my career, I cared mostly about myself and building my organization. Sadly, people were not my top priority, and I regret to say that my selfishness sometimes kept me from doing the right thing. There's one particular incident that made me realize that my priorities were wrong. I failed to help a man because I focused on myself, and then the man died, and my selfish decision meant that he would never get the help that I should have given him, and there was nothing I could do to fix that. I can't express the devastating impact this had on me. I felt terrible, and it caused me to spend several months reevaluating myself as a leader. For the first time in my life, I started to ask myself the hard questions about my motives and methods that every leader ought to ask, and I was not satisfied with my answers. During the next few months, I spent a lot of time in prayer and reflection, and I resolved to become a different kind of leader, someone different from who I had been up to that time. Thankfully, my heart was changed, and my actions started following my heart, and I became a person who valued other people and demonstrated that through my leadership decisions, which made others my top priority. The change within me was deep, and it made a difference that still influences me today. If I hadn't made this shift, my leadership would have been hollow and self-centered. I credit this with making possible whatever difference I've made in my leadership. Essentials for Transformational Leadership. I'm a firm believer in training in leadership. I've done it myself for 50 years and helped others for more than 40. But I also recognize there's a huge difference between trained leaders and leaders who are transformational. So let's look at how they compare. Trained leaders know how to lead. Transformational leaders know why they lead. Trained leaders are liked. Transformational leaders, they become contagious. Trained leaders influence today. Transformational leaders influence today and tomorrow. Trained leaders ask people to follow. Transformational leaders ask people to make a difference. Trained leaders love to lead, and transformational leaders love the people that they do lead. Trained leaders are trained, and transformational leaders are trained and transformed. Trained leaders help people. Transformational leaders help people change. Trained leaders, they have a career. Transformational leaders, they have a calling. Trained leaders impact few. Transformational leaders impact many. For many years, I've studied transformational movements and the people who led them. I've identified five actions common to all of them. If you desire to make the impact shift from a trained leader to a transformational leader, start doing these also. Number one, possess a clear picture of what transformational leaders do. On the surface, all transformational leaders look different from one another. They come in all sizes and shapes, from many races and nationalities, and with a variety of skills and talents. Their differences are many. However, there are a few characteristics that all of them share, and if you desire to become transformational, you must embrace them too. so that you know what you're striving for. Transformational leaders see things that others do not see.